Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. This past year, more than 30 books were adapted to full-length feature films, bringing favorite stories and characters to life on the silver screen. And according to The Atlantic, the top 10 grossing films of 2014 were all inspired by a pre-existing novel or comic book. So what exactly makes a book good for the big screen? Well, we'll take a look at that with New York University professor and script consultant Marion Horowitz. First, the story of Chris McCandless fascinated millions who read John Krakauer's Into the Wild. I was one of them. Sean Penn made the movie of the same name. And it was a really compelling story that had many wondering why. Why did Chris give away over $20,000 and burn what was left of his money? Why did he dump everything and everyone and head for Alaska? What did he really leave behind? What was he running from? Well, some felt that he was a spoiled brat and got what he deserved when he ventured into the last frontier without a well-formulated plan. Others thought he maybe was mentally ill. Others celebrated his free spirit and romanticized his willingness to walk alone and with nothing into the Alaskan landscape. And then there were others who felt that maybe, just maybe, we weren't hearing the whole story. Well, I'm very pleased today to have with me Corinne McCandless. She is Chris's sister. And she's joining us today to fill in some of the missing pieces, significant missing pieces, and tell us why she's now decided 20 years later to share the secrets behind the story. Her new book is called The Wild Truth. Corinne McCandless, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, we had a quick chance to chat before we started here, and I said that I was one of those people who was fascinated by Chris's story. So just for those who are not familiar with the story, let's just share a little bit about the situation. He was, I think, probably some of the most common things that came, that people repeated, were that he gave away all his money, he just walked off into Alaska, but he actually went on a road trip first. I mean, he graduated from school, he'd done exceptionally well. Tell us a little bit about that time.
Well, he did, and something that these people also don't understand, and John does write about it in his book, in Into the Wild, but people don't absorb that information sometimes, is that Chris, you know, whereas he wasn't fully prepared to go off into the wilds of Alaska the way he did, which is something that a lot of young men especially do sometimes when they feel the need to push themselves to the extreme. But you know, Chris, even when he was in high school, he would take trips and he would go on adventures. And the entire time that he was in college, on every semester break that he had, he did the same thing. I mean, I remember when he, and I write about this in my book too, when he hiked across the Mojave Desert and all these different things that he did between high school and college, where he continually pushed himself to the extremes. And, you know, he always survived, and Chris was very smart and very good at anything he tried to do, and sometimes that can be dangerous because you have to push yourself harder and kind of up the bar of the challenge. And you know, he consistently did that, and he went to Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and he graduated with honors, and he set off on this very long trek. And he started in with his car heading west, but he ended up having to abandon it in Arizona. And anyway, he set off on foot after that, and he was kind of exhilarated after that, actually, you know, getting rid of that last material crutch, I think, as he thought. And he had given away well over $20,000 to a famine relief charity, Oxfam. And when he parted with his car, he actually set fire to some of the remaining cash that he had, sort of in this, I guess, a seduce the row proud kind of way.
Right.
But Yeah, I mean, a lot of the people like Jon Krakauer and people like David Brashears and some of the people that John writes about in his book, Roman Dials, is one that comes to mind that I reference in my book as well. You know, they have this understanding and respect of Chris while they acknowledge his mistakes because they remember when they were young and male and in their 20s and how they pushed themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they remember so many times that they're surprised they made it out alive. It's a very different thing than wanting to die.
Well, I think this is why his story is so compelling and resonated with so many people, because let's face it, all of us want to just walk off to the world at some point we don't go with the intention. And he was not, and I know you want this pointed out, he did not go there to die. He wanted to go there to live and to experience.
Right. You know, I didn't write my book in defense of Chris in any way, honestly. It was a matter of people just having the facts. And there's a lot of reasons for that why I think it's very important. You know, the greatest lessons come from what makes us human, not from what makes us iconic. Mm. And I think when you kind of break things down to the simplicity of all those things within Chris that really break him down into the human condition of what people can relate to, it allows for a greater understanding. And one of those issues is the issues of domestic violence. Chris's story is a very powerful example of the devastating effects that domestic violence has on children and their families.
Right. And so you had the opportunity to share the full story when Jon Krakauer wrote the book, and again when Sean Penn did the movie, because you were a script consultant on both,
yeah.
As I understand. But you felt at that time that it was the kind thing to do to your parents not to share the full story?
Well, you know, it was a different situation when I was working with John. I really didn't understand the gravity of what was going to happen. I don't think anyone did. Nobody expected John's book to be this huge international bestseller as it was. So, you know, at the time, Chris had just recently passed, and I absolutely believed that my parents were going to learn these incredible lessons from his passing. I mean, how could you not? And unfortunately, it didn't happen. And I realized that, you know, by the time the movie came out, but it still wasn't the right time. And I certainly didn't want to vilify my parents on the silver screen. And, of course, Sean wouldn't have wanted to see that either. I did tell John and Sean a lot of the things that are in my book now because I wanted them to have that understanding of Chris, because I didn't feel that they could portray him and do justice to him properly if they themselves weren't at least aware. And I think they both did a beautiful job. But when it came time to sharing the rest of the story, I wasn't sure that I was ever going to be ready to do that. But, you know, for many years now, I have been working with students. Into the Wild is required reading at about 3,000 high schools and colleges across the United States. And when I first started going and speaking to these students, and answering their questions and answering them honestly about the reasons Chris left the way he did and why he cut off contact and what he was so angry about, I saw an incredible impact. It changed my life. It blew me away. And the most important part of that is the very first time I spoke with students, a student came to me and asked for help for the very first time because of what they were dealing with at home. And I have never left one speaking engagement since then. And regardless of the age group, I haven't left one where someone didn't come to me and talk about it for the first time. So
that's pretty amazing. And we're talking, of course, about domestic violence. So let's look at, Karine, why now? Why is now the right time for you to come forward and tell this story?
You know, I think it's a matter of finding your voice and being able to be willing to put yourself out there and know that you might be lashed back at, but to be doing something with a purpose that you believe in, and for that to be the most important thing. You know, I wrote this book with pure intent in my heart, and I just focused on truth, and Chris taught me that that's the most important thing. And becoming a mom, especially, really changed my perspective on the importance of that. And too many people still suffer in silence about the issues of domestic violence. It's something that's not spoken of as much as it should be. People might like something on Facebook or sign a petition, but do they really talk about it within their community? And, you know, the mutterings of something they think that some kids might be going through or a family down the street, it's not something people really personally address.
Right.
And, you know, as far as suffering in silence, it's something I understand. It took me 20 years to write this book, and I had opportunities to speak out beforehand, but wasn't prepared to do so. And I do not villainize my parents in the book. I try to be, I'm very honest about them, even-handed. They certainly deserve empathy for losing their son. And they didn't do everything wrong. You know, just the fact that we were born in America means that our life wasn't as hard as so many other children out there, but it doesn't negate the devastating effects of the things that they did wrong. And this book covers a lot of ground. It's about owning your mistakes and focusing on that, especially in working with students. I really want them to understand the importance of knowing that you're going to make mistakes and it's okay, and accepting responsibility for that, learning from it, and moving forward in a positive way.
Right, right. So I want to get a little into the story that wasn't shared in the book or the film, but is shared in your book, The Wild Truth. And we're going to take a quick break before we get started on that. So my guest here is Corinne McCandless, and her new book is called The Wild Truth. And it certainly answered a lot of questions that I had after I'd read Into the Wild and seen the movie, too. So please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We will be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, the product that gets the stink out, we cover the world of animals. This week, February 8th, it's a harmonic and energetic shifting Sunday with Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon in Seattle. They'll be in the studio with their acutonic forks, Tibetan bowls and bells, pua and rattles, ready to do remote sessions for you, your animal friends, your home or business. Open phone lines throughout the show, so call in early. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dr. Chris Kortman and Dr. Harold Chinitsky share their toolbox of self-help techniques and take control of your anxiety, a drug-free approach to living a happy, healthy life. Also, Carol R. Koenig explores 8 essential life skills that combat unnecessary eating and outsmarting overeating. Catch Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, here on Alternative Talk 1150. And listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm talking today with Corinne McCandless. She is the sister of Chris McCandless, who was the subject of the book and the movie Into the Wild. But today we're talking about Corinne's book, The Wild Truth, which I understand Corinne has hit the New York Times bestseller list. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And Corinne is an entrepreneur, activist, and mother, so I don't know where she found the time to write the book. She's been successfully self-employed.
That's a long time.
She's been successfully self-employed since she started her first business at the age of 19. And you'd mentioned during the first part that you give a lot of public talks. Your presentations are featured in education and corporate venues across the U.S. You talk a lot about this this book, too. But I'm wondering, let's just paint a picture. I want to get to the story that wasn't shared, and which is at the heart of your book and why you wrote this book. Because Chris was your older brother. He was always super protective of you. You write that. I mean, you can feel the love coming off the pages there. And you had a very special relationship because you did grow up in a house with domestic violence. But for all intents and purposes, somebody looking from the outside in would call this a Leave It to Beaver family. Your father was highly successful. Your mother helped him get there. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what was really going on.
Well, those things are true. You know, they were highly successful, and but they measured their success, unfortunately, through bank accounts and material things, and that was something that Chris really grew to abhor. And there was a lot of hypocrisy as well. We were brought to church every Sunday, and we were taught a lot of values within the Christian faith, which I believe Chris and I both valued very much and are grateful for. But those same actions of morality and things were not in existence behind closed doors. So it was quite confusing as a young child.
Yeah.
But the worst part of it, and the thing that I think people don't understand, you know, domestic violence takes on many forms. You have physical violence, but you also have, as the case was in our home, you know, these consistent manipulations of the truth. And it's very confusing when you're growing up. And we learned as we were growing up that our mother was our father's mistress, and that we were born while he was married to his first wife, Marcia. And I'll say Walt and Billy when I talk about my parents, not to be impersonal or in any way, but I do that so, you know, it's so confusing.
Yes, yeah, so we know who they are.
We know who they are. So,
but Walt and Billy are your parents.
Yeah, so there were six other children, and I'm the youngest of the eight, and Chris and I were born to Walt and Billy, and Marcia is the mother of the other six. And the last four of us, our ages are all intermingled. But when you're young, you don't understand what it means that your other brother, Shannon, is only 3 months older than your brother, Chris. You know, you don't even understand how children are born.
Right, because your father was actually living with both women. He'd bounce backwards and forwards at that time, right?
When we were all in California, yes, he would go back and forth. But, you know, then we ended up moving to Virginia, and Marcia, a very, very strong symbol through my book, you know, she got her children out of that situation and chose to do that. Six kids, very little money. And, you know, she knew what she needed to do as a mother and get them out of that situation. It took her quite some time, but she did it. And you know, she's one of the wealthiest women I know because she has all of her children and grandchildren around her, and
yeah,
they love and respect her.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
So, yeah, as we were growing up, what was so difficult is we didn't understand why there were so many problems and what, you know, the violence was always stemming from these types of arguments of the situation at hand and the lies and the things and the secrets and what they didn't want other people to know. We didn't understand those things ourselves. What we knew is that we were blamed for them, unfortunately. You know, we were told that the things that were happening were our fault, and Chris was 3 years older than me, so he took that blame onto his shoulders, and that's a lot of pressure to put on a little boy. And, you know, as we grew up and became teenagers, obviously we understood that it wasn't our fault, and we understood what the mixing of the ages means, and whenever we would come to our parents with those kinds of questions, we were just told more lies. So, that's the lesson here. That's the lesson here.
Yeah, and you write in the book how your parents would involve you. Your mother would scream, "Come in here, kids, and see what your father's doing to me." And your father would scream, "Come in here, and kids, and see what your mother's making me do." So I'm wondering, you know, at the end of this, you know, you say that as teenagers you recognized that it wasn't your fault, but what that did to your self-worth.
You know, yeah, it's just, you sort of struggle with identity a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Chris and I had both similarities and differences in how we dealt with that. We both left home as soon as we could, and while he went headstrong away from society, I went headstrong into society. I seemed to need to have the validation of a relationship and things to feel my worth. And I write a lot about, in the book, the things that I learned from that experience and the things I learned from Chris. I write about the things that I've learned through my successes in business and how I relate that to these lessons. You know, everything's relative in your life, and my failures in relationships and the things I've learned from that. You got to accept responsibility for the choices you make in life.
Right.
And, you know, as a parent myself, I can't even wrap my mind around the thought of losing my daughters. But moreover, I can't imagine making calculated decisions to behave in a way consistently that would result in my children feeling that they couldn't be happy without eliminating me from their lives. And I would reach out to my parents again and again about that. But I realized that I was doing a disservice to Chris and all of those that seek inspiration from him and his story, because the greatest lessons, you know, ultimately they come from truth.
Yeah.
And I should have spoken out about this a long time ago, and maybe it would have even helped my parents, because it was sort of allowing them to hide behind these lies.
But I wonder that, though, Karen, if that would have made any difference, because I see you write at the end of the book, towards the end of the book here, Mom and Dad spent part of each year living in the same city as me, and it wasn't long, and this is when you're grown and you have children, wasn't long before they heard about the discussions I was now having about our home life. And to paraphrase it, they basically said a lot of very disparaging things about you within the community, within their church. They hid behind the veil of being born again Christians. They disparaged, you say, the greatest violation was what I saw as an unforgivable encroachment on Chris's faith. Mom would consistently use Chris's last written words against him. And she's seemed in a constant state of denial to any wrongdoing, if you will.
Yeah, you know, my mom is quite a symbol in a lot of ways in this book. And when I was, through my childhood and through my adulthood, my mom would consistently talk to me about how she wanted to be a voice for battered women. She wanted to help battered women and children and help them get out of these situations. She would talk openly and honestly about the situation, you know, behind those closed doors, but you just couldn't get her to open up about that after that. And even in personal discussions, you would just get to this point where you felt you were having this incredible breakthrough and you wanted to help her and she was going to finally help herself, you know, when I was an adult and had, you know, was away from that. But literally 24 hours later, it was just, I don't know what you're talking about, Corrine. It was as if it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I realized I was withholding these lessons from people and that I had something very important to share, and I couldn't withhold it from so many, and doing that as a disservice to Chris that I felt I was doing, waiting for two people to learn them, which I finally realized, as you said, you know, it didn't see that it was was ever going to happen.
Right.
And I don't blame them for his death. I mean, I hold them accountable for his disappearance, just as people can learn so much more from Chris.
Right.
By him being taken behind that, beyond that iconic legend he's become.
Right, right.
They can learn from my parents as humans. You know, people don't learn from villains, and my parents certainly are humans that just made some mistakes.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't get the impression throughout the book that you were trying to demonize your parents. And even
right.
Even in the PBS special that was produced with your siblings in there, too, when you went to Alaska to see the buzz where Chris lived and died, I certainly didn't get, you know, that people were demonizing Walt and Billy. I did, and it's very difficult when you're watching a program, but I did feel that Billy was in La La Land as far as, you know, what really happened when she was talking to the producers. But I think it's telling, you know, they say there are three sides to every story. There's your side, his side, and somewhere in the middle is the truth.
Yeah.
But I think it's very telling that none of the siblings, none of you have a relationship with your parents. I mean, that's what, seven of you?
Eight. Well,
eight
living.
Of you. Eight of you.
Yeah, yeah. Six of us have children.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that's extremely important and something that we're very proud of. Again, six of us have children, and we've all broken that cycle of violence, and that's something that is not common, and it's something that's so important, and one of the reasons that I speak out and one of the reasons I wrote The Wild Truth. I just feel very strongly that the messages and lessons that can come from this book can do a lot of good to help people. I wish, you know, when I go and speak at schools, I wish someone had come and spoken at my school and been very open about these things.
And said it's okay to talk about it. In fact, you must,
right.
You
know,
must
say,
talk about
show it.
Show
it to them.
Yeah.
You know, you go there and you're speaking with these kids and you're talking about your own life experience. And I've had some people say to me, gosh, why didn't you just wait? You know, you waited 20 years. Why didn't you just wait longer until your parents had passed? But when you know that something is right to do and something is right to move forward on, you've got to do it right. And I think it's a little bit of a cop-out to wait to do it when no one can lash back at you. I mean, if you know the truth and you believe in it,
right.
Put it out there.
Well, you're told that as a writer. You know, if somebody's not going to lash back at you, maybe your writing's not.
Right.
Not getting to the heart of the story. But I also know as a writer, it is extremely difficult to bare your soul and have everybody be so judgmental of it and judgmental of the people you're talking about. And, you know, even though you may mean ABC, somebody else is going to take away XYZ. And so there's all that you open yourself up to. But John Krakauer wrote in the foreword of your book, that you belatedly realized even the most toxic secrets could possibly be robbed of their power to hurt by dragging them out of the shadows and exposing them to the light of the day. So I want to ask, has that happened for you? Have you felt some form of completeness or redemption in telling the rest of the story that was not told into the wild?
Well, you know, I accept responsibility for not sharing more of this story, you know, sharing it with John and Sean, but not allowing them to share it with everyone else. You know, that's part of it. But I don't know that I would have appreciated and understood the need and the importance of this without having become a mother myself. It really changed my perspective and shifted my my feelings on being willing to take that risk and knowing that I have to do it. And I think that I dealt with all of that long before I started writing. You know, I just had to let go of all of that. You know, Chris, I mean, the response to the book has been overwhelmingly positive and very well received. And most importantly, I have gotten incredible letters from students and from teachers and from young people and from parents just telling me how it's affected them. And I used to get those letters constantly from people about Into the Wild and Chris's story, and to get them now because of The Wild Truth and the rest of the story, it is, I don't know if validating is the right word, because I don't feel that I need the validation other than what comes from myself.
Right.
But it is empowering and it's inspiring, and it makes you just want to speak up more and know that you're helping people.
Right.
So, and of course, there's always the detractors as well that have their opinions as to why I've funnily spoken up, and that's fine. I mean, I just am not concerned with that.
Well, your mother is actually one of those, because you write in the book that she said, "Oh, you just want, why are you doing this? You just want attention."
Right. Yeah.
Right. So you
this is not a comfortable attention.
No, I can
but
imagine.
Honestly, my mom, as I said, spoke all the time about how she wanted to be this symbol to help women, and she is. She is through this book. I feel like I've been that voice for her that she isn't strong enough to be for herself. And
right.
Although I'm sure she, you know, I made sure they had a copy of the book before it was released, and they haven't spoken to me in years, but I made sure they were sent a copy of the book. And, you know, their reaction was to make a public statement to the media that it was fictionalized writing and had nothing to do with their son or his character. And it didn't surprise me. They never did understand their son, nor the damage they were doing to him or to any of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of my siblings have their own reasons for why they broke away. I don't want to ever speak for my siblings. Some of their voices come through loud and clear in the book. Others are present only factually by their request, because everyone has their own comfort distance from this. And it's tough to have your family in the public eye, and I respect that. So I respected that as I was writing. But it's just a matter of the facts. When you write a book with truth in the title, you've got to make sure it's right. And I did a lot of research and a lot of interviews and a lot of soul searching to make sure that I was doing this for the right reasons. And I'm proud of the result. I'm proud of the work that I feel that it can do.
Right.
And, yeah, I feel like Chris's story can just continue to live on and help people even more. I mean, you were talking about how everybody kind of wants to go off into the wild, and you're right. But what is their wild? Doesn't necessarily mean it's the wilderness.
No,
you know.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, his story just makes people think. It makes people think about living their life with purpose, and you know, really living and not simply existing.
Right, right. So you would think that your parents, you know, having lost him, would work hard to at least keep one of their kids around, and yet you talk in the book about somebody that your mother's replaced you with, a woman she befriended and introduces her as her new daughter.
Yes, there are a couple, and I do not fault these individuals in any way for this. Of course, it is not their doing or their intention, but yeah, there's a young man and a young woman who came to know my parents. You know, they were inspired by Chris's story and fans of Into the Wild, and I was let know that that was the replacement for Chris and that she was the replacement for me. So, but that just, you know, it didn't surprise me at the time that it happened, so it wasn't exactly a devastation.
Right. So a lot of the violence that happened in your home, it sounds as though it was alcohol induced or fueled, you know, to some extent.
Very much so.
Yeah. And you talk in the book about being addicted to motherhood. So tell us, tell us how.
I mean, do I put it that way? I don't know if I put it. I guess I do.
Yeah, there is
after Heather came into my life in an unusual way, I knew that I was addicted and I wanted more. I do remember writing that sentence, yes.
Yeah. Well, that's a good addiction to replace. to have, I think.
Yeah, I've never had an addiction to any type of substance, so I guess if I had to choose something, motherhood is good.
But so, and you have a segment in the book called Unconditional Love. So talk to us a little bit about what unconditional love means to you today. And I think putting that 20 years space between what happened to Chris and writing the book probably has given you a much greater perspective on this.
It has. I believe that everything happens in due time for due reasons. And I also believe that it's not all in our control, and it's not our plan. You know, as they say, people plan, God laughs. I think that we, a lot of the things that happen to us in our lives are through our own actions and intentions. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure how much in control of things we are. I was terrified. I was not, I didn't have an intention to become a mother. Even though I didn't have violent tendencies, I felt the best way to never be abusive to a child is to not have a child. And in the book, I write about how, you know, I sort of accidentally became a mother, and it was the absolute most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. Heather came into my life when she was 2 years old, and she needed a mom. And I sort of looked around trying to figure out who that was going to be and realized it was going to be me. So, but she is the greatest opportunity that has ever come into my life, and she has taught me so much. And so has Christiana, her little sister.
Your brother's namesake.
Yeah, my brother's namesake. Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us and sharing the rest of the story, which is told in The Wild Truth, which is now a New York Times bestseller by Corinne McCandless. Corinne, a final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
You know, I just want this book to give people hope. I want people to feel empowered by the knowledge that all things that happen in life, both good and bad, they bring with them opportunities to take control and begin again. And even the toughest challenges can progress in a new direction towards survival and recovery. You know, in my case, I had to navigate my way through family dysfunction and tragedy and face that I couldn't navigate successfully without acknowledging the truth.
Right.
And I've learned a lot of valuable lessons from those experiences, and I believe the lessons can help those who read them as much as it helped me to write them down. So I'm grateful and honored that I've had that opportunity.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today. And the book, again, is called The Wild Truth. It's written by Corinne McCandless, sister of Chris McCandless. And you can find out more about the book at, I believe it's your name, is it? Just tell me the
Corinne
website.
Sorry. CorinneMcCandless.com. You can find information about it.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much.
For taking me to the doctor when I broke my foot.
For leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom. For taking you to your therapies. For understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
But no one can see the film that you started. And they won't pay the price to come in to your sin.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're actually going to talk about one of my favorite things here, books and films, and why books get made into films and what makes a good film and a book. So, and to do that, we have a great expert with us. She is award-winning New York University professor and script consultant, Marilyn Horowitz. She's worked with filmmakers and produced screenwriters for over 15 years, and she's the author also of the new political thriller, The Book of Zev, which undoubtedly she hopes will get made into a movie one day. Marilyn Horowitz, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Vicki.
So one of the questions that people often ask is, why the book is never like the film. And we're going to look at that a little bit, first of all. But I remember years ago going to a conference, and it was I meant to look up her name and I forgot, but it was the person who directed Witness with Harrison Ford.
Oh, yes.
And she had this story to tell. She'd written this screenplay. She could not sell that puppy anywhere. And everyone kept telling her, you need a book. You need a book to support it. So she went away and wrote the book, got independent funding, produced the movie, etc. And the rest is history because it was a big seller.
So it was a huge seller.
So why would somebody need a book before that they wanted to produce the movie? Tell us that.
Well, I mean, that's a curious thing. I mean, you know, a book has a way of, there's this thing in Hollywood which we're all familiar called development. And development used to be something that Hollywood spent a lot of money on, and they would take an original idea and they would develop it into a screenplay. Novelists traditionally do this sort of development by themselves. It's part of the job. So by the time a novel is done, the development of really fleshing out every character and exploring every possibility has been completed. So, but when you, when I teach, you know, I teach at New York University, and I have a trademark writing system, and I teach people based on my book, How to Write a Screenplay in 10 Weeks, to do this thing. And what I explain to them at the beginning when they're working on adaptation is that a book is like a panoramic view from your window when you're on tour somewhere. And turning something into a movie is having to take a picture of that panorama with a 35-millimeter camera.
Mm. That's a good way of looking at it. I saw that of the top 10 grossing films released last year, every single one of them was inspired by a pre-existing story, whether that was a novel, a comic book, or in two cases, actually, a line of toys.
Yeah.
What makes somebody think, hey, this is going to make a good movie?
Well, because it already has a following, and it's already in the, you know, the collective consciousness. You know, everybody knows about it. And I think that the, you know, again, the hallmarks of any good story are an original or unusual setting, like, you know, the Grand Budapest Hotel has a very unusual setting, right, or 12 Years a Slave, and memorable characters. And obviously, if you have a line of toys or whatever, or Marvel Comics, you have memorable characters in the form of superheroes or animated heroes. And then lastly, you have to have a really good twisty story with a surprise ending.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are the basic components. And even when something is based on a true story, you know, how the story is told, it's not whether the guy dies as an American sniper, but how he dies, that makes that criterion relevant. But I think that the audience recognition, a preformed fan base, and, you know, the movie business is called the movie business for a reason. It's about the business. It's something that already has a brand, to use that awful word.
Right.
You know, has a better chance of success, you know, than things that are generally completely unknown. Not
right.
always the case, but often.
Right. I read that 3 movies last year in the top 10 were actually inspired by the same book. three different versions. Yeah, I was just Googling around and I saw that John Green's The Fault in Our Stars actually inspired 3 different films last year. But I wanted to talk about, you know, so often we read the book, it's the biggest complaint that readers will say, oh, I read the book and the film was nothing like the book, which
well,
of course...
Well, sure, Gone Girl, right? Gone Girl went in a different direction from the book.
Yeah. But let's look at some of the reasons behind that. And I dug out this interview that I did years ago with Gerald DePego for the Screenwriters Guild, and he's a screenwriter, and he wrote Phenomenon and Chivi and Instinct and Message in a Bottle. And so at that time when I interviewed him, he'd just written Message in a Bottle. The movie had come out, and it was so different to the book.
Yeah.
And so I asked him a couple of things. You know, why did you change, for example, what Kevin Costner did as a living? I mean, it seemed like a very innocuous, why change that? But it was because he wanted to make it more visual. So I wonder if you've got some great examples there to share of how things have changed from the book to the movie to make it more visual.
Well, not only visual. I think that there are reasons. For example, I read an interview with Richard LaGravenez that when he was going to adapt for The Bridges of Madison County, which is about a woman who has an affair with a married man.
Right.
You know, in the 40s, and everybody's like, oh, you know, that's no big deal now, who cares? And that he came up with the idea of trying to figure out who would care. And so that's why when you see the movie, the framework is her children finding out the story in the will.
Okay.
Because the fact that their mother had cheated would matter to kids, even if in the contemporary morals of the world it didn't matter.
Right, right.
So that was that's a clear example of why you'd make a substantive change.
Right.
In The Silence of the Lambs, half of the book is about how if Clarice Starling does what Crawford wants her to do, she could jeopardize her whole career as an FBI agent. And that whole subplot was completely removed. And I remember reading an interview with Ted Talley because he said there just wasn't any room for it.
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, and that's a lot of it. So some of the, I mean, and then you have, you know, awful stories where there's the story about the guy who wrote Elf, which was originally about a little boy, and it was an homage to his boy who had died. And he took it to some development executive who said, oh, it's a great story, but does it have to be about a boy? You know, and it became a better,
right.
You know, an animated. So, you know, that is a function to a certain extent of, you know, of the process of translation.
Right, right. And going back to Gerald DePego that I talked with, he had changed Kevin Costner's career, not just as a visual thing, but he changed him from being a scuba diver instructor to being a boat builder so that as Kevin Costner's character healed, people could see this boat coming to life as Kevin Costner was coming back to life. So I find it fascinating to look at those nuances and see why screenwriters change things. So,
well, it's a visual form. It's a symbolic form, of course. I mean, you know, I think that that's one of the things that makes a great movie great is that kind of symbolism.
Right. So are there elements in particular that filmmakers should look for when they're or do look for when they're, we've talked about the, you know, is this going to translate well to screen? Is there a good story there? But What other components might they look for?
Well, I think that, you know, first and foremost, I mean, what I was, the first time I ever went to Hollywood to pitch something, a producer, a very famous producer, said to me, he said, look, there are three things that we worry about. You know, who's going to be in it, how much does it cost, and who's going to see it? So I think that first and foremost, you need characters that major actors will want to play, something castable, don't you think?
Right.
And then beyond that, you want an unusual or an original setting somewhere that people haven't been before.
Right.
Because that offers, you know, the whole, you know, exoticness, you know, Grand Budapest Hotel. Thirdly, I think that you really want a story that has something that is really, really unusual. A twist, if you like, a gimmick at the low end. You know, so in a film like The Notebook, right, we find out that what we're hearing is not some fairy tale. It's, in fact, the diary of their marriage.
Yes.
Right. You need something, you know, they call it a hook or whatever.
Yes.
You know, and so if you're a producer, you're going to look for something like that. That's a surprise. And, of course, you know, you're complicit because if you have a readership for a book that you're adapting, everybody wants to see how you're going to do it. No one's going to give it away. So you're very safe.
So if a writer is starting a book and they want to get it, and I want to talk very quickly about options too, but if they think, I want to make it, you know, a movie, a book that's going to be made into a movie, what do they need to keep in mind when they're writing?
Well, I mean, what I did with my own book, the book Zev, was I kept in mind that it needed to be in a genre. And so even though it was basically a literary fiction, I shifted it so that it would have a thriller, you know, so that it became a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're writing a story, write it by all means. But then when you're done, think about tilting it just a little bit so that it'll be easier, you know, for someone to say. What I tell my students is that, you know, you can make your own crazy grapes, but ultimately we have to get them in a bottle so people would know what kind of wine to buy.
Right. Right. So you actually had that in mind before you started writing your book, The Book of Zev.
Well, after the first draft, I did. You know, in other words, I believe and I tell my students that the first work has to be for yourself, that you have mm-hmm. to get the thing written. You know, however messy it comes out, you have to let it come out or you'll never fix it. But once out, when you start to rewrite it and revise it, you have to be aware of your audience.
Yeah. And you know, people have, I've run into a lot of authors who say, oh yeah, my book is optioned. And, you know, that doesn't mean it's going to get made into a movie. It just means you have an option of it. And I talked with Patricia Cornwell a little while ago. 72 million copies she's sold, and still nobody's picked up that they have an option, but they still haven't produced a film for her.
Right. So, well, you buy an option, and also to get it off the market. It's like, you know what I mean. It's like, you know, you get engaged to someone, so they can't. No, you haven't gotten married yet, but you know, you got the ring on the finger. That's
so.
You know, that's kind of the approach.
Well, that's a good way to end the segment on, because I think we're going to be careful in both places, which partners.
Be very careful. Beware of men carrying big rigs.
There we are. I could talk to you for a long time on this subject. Like I said, it's one of my favorites, but we're right.
Well, we seem to have a lot in common.
Yes, we're right at the end of our segment, unfortunately. And I'm going to get chased out of here in a minute. But I thank you, Marilyn Horowitz, so much for being with us. People can find out more about Marilyn Horowitz and her book, The Book of Zev, and her trademark writing plan at marilynhorowitz.com. That's correct, right?
Thank you so much. And, you know, if anybody has questions or whatever, you know, I am a writing coach, so I'm, you know, that's what I do.
All right. Thank you so much, Marilyn Horowitz. Appreciate it. And we are at the end of our segment, so our end of our show. So I want to thank you for being with us today. We will be back next week with an all live news show. And you can reach me at 800-495-7617 if you have questions or comments on today's show. 800-495-7617. Or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. You can also connect with us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair, just Vicky St. Clair. All right, we'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair.
If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Dr. Chris Kortman and Dr. Harold Chinitsky share their toolbox of self-help techniques and take control of your anxiety, a drug-free approach to living a happy, healthy life. Also, Carol R. Koenig explores 8 essential life skills that combat unnecessary eating and outsmarting overeating. Catch Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, here on Alternative Talk 1150. And listen to past shows at conversationslive.net.